Linville, Tennessee is a community of less than 300 people. You know, the prosperous days of cotton and the mills are long gone. The historic train depot and aging downtown storefronts are a reminder of days gone by. So it's no wonder that this sleepy little town would be rocked by the events of November the 15th, 1995. It was a cold fall day in southern Middle Tennessee. By the time the first bell rang at Richland High School, the temperatures had reached a frigid 25 degrees. But no one knew that the gray skies that morning were a somber sign of things to come. A day that would soon be darkened beyond anyone in Linville's wildest imagination. 17-year-old Jamie Rouse arrived at school with a .22-caliber Remington Viper semi-automatic rifle. Within moments of entering the building, the sounds of gunfire erupted. Screaming and crying filled the school, and before the shooting would end, three people would be shot, and two would die. This is the unbelievable story of the Richland High School shooting.
Recorded in Rocket City, USA. No bullshit. Just real talk. And now Deuce Conrad.
The rural Giles County, Tennessee town of Linville is about as country as you can get. The town was built upon hard work, especially in agriculture. Though its mill and train depot are long gone, farming remains very much a part of its culture. Jamie Rouse, by all definitions of rural Tennessee, stood out like a sore thumb. His dark clothes and long stringy hair screamed trouble. And deep beneath his outward appearance lay a troubled and dark soul on the verge of exploding. Jamie tried to console himself by drinking. Alcohol only added to the fire. And before too long, drugs were added to the mix along with death metal music. He now says the music and violent images were filling an emptiness inside and that their message made him feel powerful. Rouse said, "I guess for so long I felt helpless and weak, and with violence, you know, you have control. I'm not saying that its music made me did what I did, because ultimately it was my choice, but it helped shape who I was." The film Natural Born Killers also made a big impression on him. "It made killing look easy and fun," says Rouse. "I mean, it fascinated me." Cheryl Rouse, his mother, said that the fact that her son was dressed in all black, listened to loud music, and loved violent movies didn't set off any alarms at the time. "To me, that was just a typical teenager, you know. One minute they're mad, and the next minute they're okay." In hindsight, most tragedies had early warning signs that were often missed. Jamie Rouse was no different. "You see, at home there was yelling and fighting. The yelling was because of me," says Rouse's father, Ellison, a truck driver who now admits he was part of the problem in his son's life. Ellison said, "To this day, I still believe if I'd been home that day, I'd been the one that died and the teachers wouldn't have. I believed he'd kill me. That was the cause of most of his problems, I felt like." But even the failures of his father were not the entire reason for Jamie's feeling of failure. Rouse says he was desperately unhappy, and it started when he was a child, bullied by classmates for being small and too quiet. Ellison was on the road for most of Jamie's childhood, and at the time, using drugs and drinking heavily. When he was home, Rouse says, Ellison was often angry. "One of the earliest memories I have was sitting on my mother's lap and she was crying, and I can remember my dad punching holes in the door and walls because he was drunk," says Rouse. "I knew that he was capable of actual violence." Rouse says he learned how not to cry because he was afraid of his father. "I knew what happened if I cried around my dad. I just stuffed it in. I didn't expose that," says Jamie. It had a big impact. You don't know how to deal with problems when they do happen, and it just snowballs until eventually something gives. As time went on, Rouse's reactions became more destructive and more dangerous. But no one took it seriously, not even when he pulled a gun on his brother. His father merely took his gun away for a couple of months. Right there, that sent the signal that, you know, that I wasn't going to get help from him, because to me, that's a pretty big deal when a sibling pulls a gun on another, says Rouse. They didn't think that anything, I guess, was severely wrong. Cheryl Rouse says that her son kept all of his emotions inside. If he let off steam, it wasn't around us. When he was around us, he was a perfect teenager. People were scared of me. I was a normal kid, and I didn't want people to be scared of me. I wanted to be just like, you know, everyone else, says Rouse, who says his life in 1995 fell out of control. Jamie said, I was under a lot of stress. I guess I blamed alcohol and the teachers. And I was so filled with, you know, hate and anger and this evil that, you know, I guess in a way I felt that, you know, they should be punished too. He says he went to school that Wednesday morning prepared to hunt down teachers. But someone else got in the way. His best friend's sister. Diane Collins was accidentally shot when Rouse says he missed the teacher he was aiming for. Of all the people I could have shot, I keep asking myself, why her?
Are you looking for unbiased news in a world of biased media? Look no further. 1440 provides an impartial view of what's happening in the world so our readers can form their own conclusions. 1440 scours hundreds of sources each and every day to bring you a single morning briefing thoughtfully curated by experts, straight to your email with no haggling or unnecessary spam. Get even more benefits by signing up through the Deuce Conrad Show affiliate link. Visit www.deuceconradshow.com and select promotions to sign up today.
On this particular morning, Jamie puts on black jeans and a black t-shirt, emblazoned with a picture of the heavy metal band Pantera. As Jamie leaves for school with a cousin, Jamie reaches for a Remington Viper 22 caliber rifle on his gun rack. He goes to his father's closet and takes down a brick of cartridges. It holds 500 rounds. Jamie uses a lot of bullet squirrel hunting and target practicing, and Ellison buys them by the brick because they're cheaper. There are 443 rounds left. They are Winchester long rifle high velocity bullets. Jamie slips 10 into a magazine. He takes the Viper, the magazine, and the rest of the bullets outside, and he tucks them out of sight near the house. Now, Cheryl Rouse has a routine. She sets her alarm for 5:30 a.m., gets up, makes coffee, and drinks a cup. And only then does she awaken her eldest, Jamie. Next, she wakes up Jeremy and finally Adam. When she takes Adam to meet his bus while the two older boys get dressed, unbeknownst to her, Jamie is planning his attack. Cheryl returns from the bus stop and sits for a moment in her brown cloth recliner. She says goodbye to Jamie as she always does. Have a good day. See you this afternoon. But this morning, however, does not reply with his usual later. Instead, he stops just inside the front door, and with a hesitation that will haunt her forever, he turns to look at his mother. Well, he says, I guess I'll go now. As he steps onto the narrow porch and starts down the stairs, Steve Abbott calls. Steve is one of his best friends. Jamie is still in the yard. Cordless receiver in hand, Cheryl goes to the door. She shouts to wait. Her voice barely carries in the misty morning through the sycamores and the dogwoods. Jamie takes the phone. Steve asks when he will be at his house to pick him up for school. A little early, Jamie replies. In fact, he is on his way. He returns the telephone to his mother and she takes it back inside. Now with Cheryl out of sight, Jamie goes to a group of bushes where he has hidden the Viper. Jamie places the rifle, the magazine, and the bullets onto the seat of the family pickup, and he drives out of Tite Barcala. 75 miles south of Nashville, the hollow is named for an early settler, so stingy that people said he was tight as the bark on a tree. Jamie stops in the nearest town, Frank Ewing, population 300, where Steve Abbott is waiting. Jamie puts a Morbid Angel CD into his new Sony Discman and turns it up. The lyrics, hate work, my work, hate work, and the earth's left burning, I call death. Death is answering me. Steve Abbott sees the gun, the magazine, and the ammunition on the seat. The night before, he remembers Jamie had told him he was going to kill a girl at school, the principal, a coach, and a state trooper who had given him 2 speeding tickets. Steve eyes the rifle. Who's that for, he asks. Jamie replies, it's going to happen today. Steve has heard that Jamie make threats before, even against a girlfriend and his own brother, Jeremy. But Jamie has never done anything. Besides, Steve knows him. They have worked together on cars, hiked in the woods, played Super Nintendo. Gun or no gun, he thinks Jamie is a friend, not a killer. Rouse later recalled it was a semi-automatic, but I liked the way it looked, too. That was the one I wanted. It didn't look like any old-timey gun. It looked like a modern gun. I mean, that's the way it was. Black. On their way out of Frank Ewing, they stop at a BP station. Jamie stocks up on Marlboros. With a rifle across his lap, he drives towards Linville, population 357. He turns on Abernathy Road and stops at the hillside home of another friend, Stephen Ray. The radio is turned up loud. Stephen walks up and rags him about it. Then he sees the gun and the bullets. The day before, he remembers Jamie had said something about getting a cop and stealing his car. Stephen thought Jamie was kidding. He poked him and he said, I'll help if I can drive. Now Stephen asks, who are you going after? Either Jamie or Steve, the music is too loud to tell, laughs and replies, Hobbs and whoever gets in the way. Wayne Hobbs is the high school principal. Stephen Ray does not believe it. He replies, you're crazy. Jamie suggests to Steve Abbott that they switch places. Steve drives a Chevy pickup truck down Abernathy Road. All the while, Stephen Ray trails in his car. Steve turns right onto Buford Station Road, and Jamie holds the rifle in his lap. Steve hears him say that now he can shoot the trooper who usually parks in front of the Richland campus. Steve begins to wonder. Hell, he even begins to worry. Jamie has to be joking. This has to be just acting big. When they turn right onto Highway 31, they will be able to see the school. It is a collection of single-story tan brick buildings with gray trim and covered walkways sprawled alongside the road. Steve will later say that if there was a cop, he would have turned south away from the school. But the trooper's not there. So he turns north towards the campus. Maybe now Steve thinks Jamie will drop whatever is bothering him and forget about it. Steve pulls the pickup into the main entrance for students and he turns left to park where he usually does, up by the football field. No, wait, Jamie says, park over here in the front. It is Jamie's truck, so Steve leaves it. Nose out alongside several cars on a strip of grass in front of the 2 portable classrooms near the north doors of the school. Jamie grabs the rifle and jumps out. the magazine is in. And only now does Steve believe that Jamie is about to do something.
Do you have a beard? It's a legitimate question. You know, a beard says a lot about a man. A beard can define a man just by looking at him. Screw what they say. You can judge a book by its cover, and a beard is one hell of a cover. But let me ask you this, how do you take care of your beard? Are you putting chemicals into your face that will basically eat the hide off of a zombie? Stop that shit. Be a badass and start using badass beard care. Look, it's all natural. It's made by badass vets. And it will make your beard so incredibly soft, so incredibly manly. And you can get a free trial set today by going to deuceconrad.com and selecting Own Promotions.
Steve hurls his door open. Jamie, he yells, but Jamie keeps walking. Jamie, he yells again and again. But Jamie doesn't stop. Steve gives chase, but he gets scared. He freezes up, he slows down, and he tries to run. But Jamie is more than 20 feet ahead of him. At 7:55 a.m. on Wednesday, November the 15th, 1995, James Ellison Rouse walks into the North Hall at Richland School. His hair is cropped in back and on the sides, but it is a foot long on top and is tied in a ponytail. He has an average IQ of 115. He's 5'7" tall, and he weighs 122 pounds soaking wet. He has a deep voice, short strides, and a hunched over gait. Carrying his Remington Viper 22 caliber rifle fully loaded. Jamie Rouse walks through double doors and down the hallway. It is noisy. He walks to the right, a foot or two from the cinder block wall, which is lined with steel lockers. He paces by four classrooms, all of which have students and teachers inside. Today he walks with his head up. His pace is normal. He walks with the butt of the rifle tucked up under his right arm like a hunter carrying a gun through a field. Some students walk in front of him, others walk behind, still others pass him going the other way. Some notice his gun. They think it is a joke. One of them happens to notice his face, and they say it is blank, and Jamie does not speak. Carolyn Foster and Carol Yancey, teachers with classrooms diagonally across from each other, are talking about cooking. It is Carolyn's turn to host Thanksgiving dinner for her extended family. She has asked Carol for a recipe. "I'll have it this morning," Carol tells her, and they go into Carolyn's classroom to make a copy. They step back into the hall and are going over the directions when Jamie walks by. They are the first teachers he sees. Both look up. Carol Yancey thinks, "What are you doing with that gun?" A student hears Carolyn Foster ask, "Jamie, what are you doing?" Jamie does not say one thing at all. With confidence, he lifts the rifle to his shoulder and he aims. He tries to fire, but the safety is on, so he flicks it off and he shoots. Because the Viper is semi-automatic, he does not have to recock it. He aims again and pulls the trigger once more. One bullet hits Carol Yancey on the left side of her forehead below the hairline. It makes a small hole and explodes fragments of her skull into her brain. The bullet expands and blows a larger hole in her skull above her left ear as it leaves. It tears off a big patch of scalp. The other bullet hits Carolyn Foster in her upper lip. It knocks out two teeth, shreds her tongue, and severs her right carotid artery and her right jugular vein. It lodges in the right side of her neck. Both teachers fall. Carol Yancey strikes her head very, very hard. Blood flows from Carolyn Foster's mouth and pink froth bubbles from her nose. She looks up. She tries to get up, but she cannot. Some students look at Jamie and they say he wore an empty grin. Carol Yancey, at the time, was 50 years old and had taught for 4 years. They'd stayed home to raise three children, then taught for 8 more years, math and science, mainly up to 7 classes in 1 year. Many of the students at Richland call her their favorite teacher. Doctors will decide it is too dangerous to try to remove bone fragments from her brain. She will carry them forever. In fact, much of her head will be numb for years, maybe forever. She will have no desire to return to teaching, mostly because she will be afraid to turn her back on a classroom of students. You see, Jamie Rouse had been in one of her classes, yet they never had a crossword. Jamie said, "I don't remember feeling angry. I wasn't feeling nothing. Like I said, I don't remember feeling anything, period. Empty, hollow. I guess that empty would be probably the best word. I wasn't the same. I wasn't feeling anything, and that's the point, all day. I mean, you know, I was empty the whole day. Just nothing." Carolyn Foster, 8 years older than Miss Yancey, is a favorite among the students, too. She had taught at Richland for 17 years. Typing, computer keyboarding, and other business skills. In fact, she and her husband owned a wholesale flower shop in Pulaski and were well connected in the community. Carolyn had survived a tornado. She had survived cancer. But on this day, she would bleed to death on the hallway floor of Richland School. Her husband will be so bereft that their daughters will spend the night worrying that he might take his own life. He will tell his grandchildren where their granny has gone. And it will be the hardest thing he has ever done. You see, one grandson would turn 4 within days, worried that he is somehow to blame for his grandmother's death. Another grandson will take his first steps, and her son will weep because she is not there to see it. A sister's husband will die of a stroke, and the sister will think that the slaying hastened his death. One student screams, another drops her books and runs. Others shout as Jamie walks on. With one hand, he holds the Viper in the air. Near the administrative offices are 2 elementary classrooms. One is for second graders, including Jamie's brother Adam, and the other is for kindergartners. Some of the youngest are returning from breakfast in the cafeteria, and others are being dropped off by their parents and are walking through the main entrance to the school near the offices. 1 6-year-old is standing outside the classroom. He does not understand. A teacher's aide sees him. "Let's go in here," she suggests, and gives him a gentle push through the classroom doorway. Jamie keeps walking. He turns east towards the cafeteria. It contains 200 students and the doors are open. The hall is packed and as many as 100 students and teachers are hurrying to their classes. Jamie walks on. He raises the rifle to his shoulder, aims and shoots. A bullet strikes Diane Collins, a freshman. She is standing 15 feet away next to a friend. The bullet cuts into the right side of Diane's neck just above her collarbone. It tears through her right carotid artery and her right jugular vein and rips a large hole in the back of her neck. The bullet ricochets off a cinder block wall and it burrows into the ceiling. Diane turns in a circle, spurting blood with every beat of her heart. She places both hands on her throat, then stares at them. They're covered with her blood. Her knees buckle. She breaks her fall and leaves two bloody handprints on the floor. She sits, then gazes across the hall at a boy and a girl who are petrified. Diane Collins was at the wrong place, at the wrong time. She's barely 14 years old. She sings, she writes poetry, she's the best friend of Jamie's brother, Jeremy. Along with Steve Abbott, her brother Bill is one of Jamie's two best friends. Her little sister, Chrissy, is in the second grade with Jamie's brother, Adam. They ride the school bus together, and they are good friends. Jamie is at the Collins home a lot. Bill is at Jamie's house. So much that he calls Jamie's parents Mom and Dad. Diane Collins will be taken by an ambulance to a hospital in nearby Columbia, Tennessee, and then by helicopter to Vanderbilt University Medical Center in Nashville, where she will die at 10:54 a.m. Her parents cannot hold her. They can't comfort her. And they can't look in her eyes and say they love her. All they can do is wonder how scared she must have been. They cannot even tell her goodbye. All they can do is claim her body, blue, purple, and swollen. Her parents feel as if they were killed along with her. Jamie, they say, will never suffer enough. When you're in that state of mind where you're going to kill someone, nothing matters, says Jamie Rouse. I wasn't expecting to, you know, come back alive. But of all the people I could have shot that day, I keep asking myself, why her?
Acorns is the leading micro investing app in the United States. It's easy to use. Mobile-first technology makes it simple for anyone to set aside and invest life spare money. Acorns allows customers to automatically invest in a low-cost, diversified portfolio of exchange-traded funds offered by some of the world's top asset managers, including Vanguard and BlackRock. Customers grow their wealth in one of five portfolios constructed with help from world-renowned Nobel Laureate economist Dr. Harry Markowitz. Acorn's smart portfolio algorithms automatically work in the background of life, helping users build wealth naturally, pennies at a time. From Acorns, mighty oaks do grow. Hey, I'm using Acorns, and I love how easy it is to save and invest for my future. Join me, and you'll get a free $5 investment. Go to www.deuceconradshow.com and select the promotions link, and from there, you can sign up directly with Acorns.
Ron Shirley, a coach, hears the shot. He thinks it's a firecracker, and he takes five steps toward the noise. He sees Diane, the blood gushing from her throat, and he reaches towards her. Puts one hand on her neck to stop it and another around her waist. And then he looks over his shoulder. He sees Jamie with a rifle. Ron Shirley lifts Diane and carries her away. Some students begin to scream. Others pour out of their classrooms. Get out of the hall, he shouts. Get out of the hall. Gently he lays Diane on the floor in the teacher's work area near the language arts department, and he fears that Jamie will walk around the corner and shoot her again. In desperation, he tries to close the wound in her throat. A teacher brings paper towels to compress it. The school has a nurse. He asks someone to find her. You see, in his mind, he sees Jamie's face, and it's without expression. James Nichols, who teaches agriculture, is standing no more than 3 feet from Jamie when Diane is shot. He sees Jamie out of the corner of an eye. With his right hand, he reaches out and he grabs the rifle. Give me that, Jamie, he says. They struggle. He spins Jamie against a wall. Jamie goes down. They wrestle into the center of the hall. They grapple for the rifle and it goes off. A bullet hits a wall and careens into the ceiling. He flattens Jamie onto the floor face up and he yells for help. Two students pile on top of Jamie's head and shoulders. In the north hall, Ralph Johnson, who teaches biology and chemistry, is cradling Carolyn Foster's head in his lap. She is struggling and bleeding heavily. She tries again to get up. He comforts her, but he realizes that he cannot do much. He hears one of the gunshots near the cafeteria and then the other. He has only one thought, get that gun. And reluctantly, he leaves Carolyn Foster and runs towards the sound. He turns the corner in time to see the fray. He falls on Jamie's chest and slips one hand over the trigger guard so it cannot be fired again. He tries to remove the magazine, but it won't come out. Jamie, James Nichols says, give me that gun. Jamie replies, I can't. I've went too far. Johnson pushes on the rifle at the same time Nichols pulls. It takes them both, but they tear the Viper out of Jamie's hands. Nichols carries it to the principal's office and unloads it. Johnson, still pinning Jamie to the floor, feels a tap on his shoulder. We have him, someone says. He looks up to see a deputy sheriff who teaches an anti-drug abuse class to fifth graders. The deputy takes Jamie into custody, stands him against the wall, and asks him if he has any more weapons. Jamie replies no. The deputy handcuffs him and out of procedure pats him down to be sure. He turns Jamie over to a second deputy who marches him out of the school and drives him in his patrol car into Pulaski, the county seat. Shortly after, the telephone rings at the Rouse home. Cheryl Rouse sits at a desk in the living room. She had turned on her computer and picks up the phone. Hello? In this very instant, her life divides into before and after. Aunt Cheryl, you've got to come to the school right now. It's her niece, a freshman. Aunt Cheryl, she says loud and fast, either Jamie's been shot or he has shot somebody. What? Jamie has shot somebody. Or he's been shot. The line is silent. Jamie, her niece repeats. Jamie Rouse, your son. Jamie is 17 and a senior. He and his brothers, Jeremy, 14, and Adam, 7, attend Richland, which is the regional elementary and secondary school in Linville, about 20 minutes away. Now, Cheryl is a whisk, 5'2", 98 pounds, and she's 40 years old and has dark hair flecked with gray and deep brown eyes. Her husband, Ellison, has been on the road for 2 days driving an 18-wheeler somewhere in the South. In the half hour since the boys have gone to school, she has taken a shower, put on jeans and a sweatshirt, and sat at her compact computer to work on an inventory of shock absorber parts for Gabriel Ride Control Incorporated over in Pulaski. Her hair is still wet. She's barefoot. She runs to the bedroom, grabs some socks and tennis shoes. She finds her purse and she races out the door. It is getting colder, but she does not put on a coat. Jamie has a Chevy pickup, so she runs on. The chill air blows through her damp hair. Her tennis shoes crunch on the gravel. She turns an ankle and stumbles, but regains her footing and keeps running. It's a short dash now to the home of her husband's mother. Panting out of breath, Cheryl knocks. It's at this moment that she feels a stab of guilt. She cannot look Jamie's grandmother in the eye. Jamie shot someone at school and he's been shot, Cheryl says. Beth called and said, I don't know any details, that's all I know. is what she said. She takes her mother-in-law's car and turns right onto Tite Bark Road, then left onto Beach Hill Road past the Church of Christ, where she and Ellison attend every Sunday, and on Wednesdays as often as possible. Two more right turns, then a left onto Buford Station Road. Dozens of cars pass her going the other way, kids, all of them leaving the school. Something is definitely wrong. She grips the wheel. Her knuckles are white. She feels shaky, a little weak. She had felt her blood drain during the phone call, and it is yet to come back. A right turn onto Highway 31, and she pulls into the driveway at the school. By now, it's 8:30 a.m. A half hour after classes usually start, Richland has 1,400 students and teachers. Hundreds are outside. Some are crying. She parks in the first space she could find and runs through the main doorway. It opens into a lobby in the administrative offices. Students and teachers are milling about, some in tears. Straight ahead is a hallway, but its doors are closed. She looks to her left up another hallway. It is sealed with yellow tape. The tape says, "Police crime scene. Do not cross." "Who are you?" someone demands. Softly, Cheryl Rouse gives her name. "This is the perpetrator's mother," a man says. Everyone looks. The significance of the word perpetrator does not sink in. Cheryl says that her niece was called to say that Jamie has shot someone and that he's been shot. Another man takes her to an office. "Somebody will come out and talk to you in a little bit." "What about Jamie?" she asks.
Hey, Deuce Conrad here. I just want to tell you about Ibotta. Ibotta is one of the greatest things I have ever laid my eyes on. It's a great tool for actually earning money. And trust me, I've tried all these surveys and everything that the internet seems to say that you're going to make money, but nothing has made me money like Ibotta. In my first week of trying Ibotta, I earned approximately $40 just shopping. It's like coupon savings for people that don't like to clip coupons. Anyways, there is a link in the description of this podcast for you to become a partner with me in Ibotta. And when you submit your first receipt, you'll earn $10. That simple, that easy, just by going and shopping at places that you're already shopping, such as Walmart, Kroger, Publix. And it's easy to cash out as well. You can get gift cards to Amazon or have a direct payment made to you. Anyways, check the link down below. Use the referral code KAXRFWJ and earn $10 on your first receipt submitted.
It is Jeremy who learns first whom Jamie has shot. His teacher pulls him into a classroom away from the horror. Now, Jeremy wants to know, so she tells him what his brother has done. When Jamie hears that one of Jamie's victims is Diane Collins, he wants to beat Jamie to choke him. But the teacher brings Jeremy to his mother. She tells Cheryl that Jamie has shot two teachers, Carolyn Foster and Carol Yancey, as well as a student, Diane Collins. She says Miss Foster is dying, but she adds that Miss Yancey and Diane are still alive. "Diane," Cheryl says. "Diane Collins," Jeremy replies, trying to make it sink in. "Diane Collins," Cheryl asks. "My gosh, Jamie shot Diane." Cheryl knows that Jamie would not hurt Diane for anything. Jeremy begins to cry. He hugs his mother and she holds him and they weep. "What has Jamie done?" Cheryl asks. "To these families." Jeremy's teacher holds both of them. "Go ahead," she says, and cry. This is a nightmare, Cheryl says. This is not happening. It's like a nightmare and I can't wake up. I know, the teacher says. I know what you mean. Silently, Cheryl prays for Diane. Please, God, she pleads, don't let her die. Then she prays for Carol Yancey. Adam's teacher takes him to an office away from the blood. His only comfort is that his friend Chrissy Collins, Diane's little sister, has been brought to the office too. They sit together. Adam has seen the yellow tape, but he and Chrissy are not sure what is happening. Adam's teacher is with them, but she does not say anything. Adam is growing scared. Finally, Jeremy walks in. Where's Mom? Adam asks. On Interstate 65 near Franklin, a few miles south of Nashville, a telephone rings in the cab of a Kenworth. It is pulling a flatbed trailer carrying 40,000 pounds of cold steel. Cheryl's husband, Ellison, picks up the receiver. The night before, he'd loaded lumber in southern Alabama and driven up to Clarksville, Tennessee, northwest of Nashville. He had napped for 3 hours in the sleeper behind his cab. Then he had driven into Nashville and loaded the steel. Now, he's headed south, bound for Gabriel Shock Absorber Plant in Pulaski. The telephone call is from Ellison's boss, who says his son will meet him at exit 46 behind a small truck stop cafe called Stan's. Drivers do this now and then to swap trucks, trailers, or loads. But when Ellison sees the son pull up in a pickup along with another driver, he knows something is wrong. His first thought is that his mother has died or that there's been an accident. Ellison, I can't tell you, the boss's son says, because all I've heard is hearsay. But there has been some trouble at Richland School, and you need to come with me. Ellison's next thought is Jeremy. Ellison has been to school many times because his middle-aged son gets into a lot of fist fights. At least once he was in the principal's office promising that Jeremy would never fight again, when at that moment Jeremy was at the far end of the school in still another fight. With Jeremy and fighting on his mind, he talks all the way to school about a telephone hotline and several other programs that he would like to begin as a community service for all the teenagers who need help. As the pickup approaches the school, Ellison sees a platoon of TV news trucks. The police are everywhere. Sheriff's deputies, patrolmen from Pulaski, state troopers, even detectives from the Tennessee Bureau of Investigation. Ellison's fears turn to Jamie. Maybe Jamie had been in a fight. You know, he's not much of a fighter. Maybe he's hurt, perhaps dead. A deputy stops Ellison at the door. Now it's 10:30 a.m. I'm Ellison Rouse, he says. I understand something is happening with my son here. The deputy steps aside. Ellison sees a teacher who's a friend of the family. And Ellison holds out his hand. But awkwardly, the teacher does not shake. What's going on? Ellison asks. What's happening? The teacher stares. He is pale and he looks ill. Ellison tries to speak to two other people. Then he sees the yellow tape. Finally, he spots his nephew, also a senior. Uncle Ellison. Jamie has shot some people and killed some people. Aunt Cheryl is in the coach's office and here. Michael Chapman, the sheriff's chief investigator, stands at the door. He lets Ellison in and says he will be back to ask some more questions. Ellison goes straight to Cheryl. He holds her and they both cry. Cheryl tells him that Jamie has shot Diane Collins and the two teachers. Diane and Carol Yancey are still alive, but Carolyn Foster is dead. Cheryl does not recall, but Ellison vividly remembers that she looks at him and says, "Our son's a murderer." Ellison Rouse is 38 years old, 6 foot and an inch tall, and weighs 220 pounds. Much of it is muscle. He kneels and puts his elbows on the seat of a chair. He buries his face in his hands and he weeps. In his grief, it does not penetrate who Diane is. Please, he prays, let the girl live. Please let the girl live. And please let Miss Yancey live. And Cheryl's pain is so great that it seems physical. If only she could trade places with his victims. Why didn't he do it to me instead of them? It wouldn't be as hard. She wants more than anything to tell the families how sorry she is. If only she could trade places with Jamie, and then she thinks of Jeremy and Adam. Jamie's not her only son, she tells herself. She tries in vain to stop crying. She repeats, I've got two other kids. Jeremy brings Adam to their parents. He tells them that their big brother had shot somebody. Whoa, Adam replies. He cannot believe it. The two boys walk in to find their mother and father crying. Jamie has done something very bad, their mother says, and he might not ever come home. Their father is more direct. Jamie has shot three people. Both Ellison and Cheryl hold their boys as tightly as they can. Adam has never seen his parents weep like this. Investigator Chapman returns to the room along with Sheriff Eddie Bass. They want to know why Jamie had refused to give up the gun. Several people in the melee say that they pleaded. Jamie would need the gun, but there ain't no sense to this. Give me the gun. My God, Cheryl replies, he was going to kill himself. Did he have some reason to shoot Diane Collins? Cheryl is numb. No. No way he cared about Diane Collins.
Since 1999, Rakuten has paid its members over $2 billion in cash back. Formerly known as Ebates, Rakuten is an affiliate reseller of over 2,500 online retailers. Rakuten passes part of their commission on their sales back to you in the form of a cashback payment. You see, you earn cash back by using the Rakuten online shopping portal. And using Rakuten is very simple and easy. There are no fees or forms you need to fill out to get your money. But to get the cash back, all you have to do is start any online shopping you do at the Rakuten website. You'll click through their site to your preferred online store, such as Target, Walmart, Sephora, Macy's, Nike, and many more. And then simply make your purchase as usual. Easy, right? Well, I'm going to make it even better for you being a listener of the Deuce Conrad Show. As a first-time shopper, you will get up to $30 to use on your first purchase. Of course, certain terms and conditions apply. Visit www.deuceconradshow.com and select promotions to get started today.
Ellison Rouse is glassy-eyed. Carol notices in shock. He is disgraced. Angry. He's angry at himself as a father. He is angry at Jamie for what he has done to his victims, to his own family, and to himself. Ellison does not recall, but Cheryl and Carol vividly remember that he says, I wished it was Jamie dead instead. No, don't say that, Carol responds. As long as there's a breath in his body, there's hope for his soul. You're right, Ellison replies. Her words remind him that Carolyn Foster is a Christian indeed. A Christian of his own denomination, the Church of Christ. She will go to heaven, but Jamie has yet to be saved. She asks herself over and over how her son could have done such a thing, and she begins to suspect he had to have been really hurting badly himself to do something like that. She and Ellison ask to see him just before they leave for Pulaski, where he's behind bars. They hug Carol and they say another prayer. It's for Carol Yancey and for Diane Collins. First time I felt anything was in the holding cell. When they first arrested me, they had me in a little juvenile holding cell, and the TV was in the back room somewhere. I could hear it. And that's when I first felt anything. When they explained what happened at school, I was just, my God, what have I done? It was unbelievable sorrow. I don't know the words to describe it. It was a horrible feeling. Oh, my God, what have I done? I just broke down crying. I remember saying, please, God, don't let them die. It was the most horrible feeling I ever had. I had pure pain and sorrow. That's when I actually caved in. That's when it just, I guess, there was a break. It was a tainted kind of dirty feeling, a sick feeling. I sat there and bawled for no telling how long. I mean, it just all came out in a constant flood. I remember when they were taking me to see my parents, I saw my dad crying. There was only one time I'd seen my dad cry before, and that was when his dad had died. He was a different person when I saw him cry. This was the first time I'd seen him cry for me. Cheryl and Ellison leave Jeremy and Adam in a foyer at the Giles County Youth Services office. Jamie enters in handcuffs. Carol takes his face into her hand. She strokes his hair out of his eyes and tells him, Jamie, I still love you. His parents sit with him through an interrogation by Michael Chapman. They think there is no harm in letting Chapman ask their son why he did this. They want to know themselves. And so they waive his right to the presence of a lawyer. It was during this interrogation that Chapman announces that Diane Collins has died along with Carolyn Foster. He says Jamie will be charged with their murders. Jamie cries. The reason for what he has done, I don't know, he says. He offers no more than an unlikely smattering of car troubles, a restriction on his driver's license, a mistaken accusation that he's been a truant, an argument with a student about a fender bender, and difficulties with an English teacher the year before. Is there something I done, Jamie? Ellison asks. No, Jamie says. Nothing y'all have done. Chapman asks not only about motive, but premeditation. Through tears and a clutter of inaudible responses, Jamie offers an apology. Within 48 hours, they hear that investigators have arrested Jamie's friend Steve Abbott. The district attorney is already charging Jamie with premeditated murder of teacher Carolyn Foster, the murder of student Diane Collins while trying to shoot Coach Ron Shirley, and the attempted murder of teacher Carol Yancey. Now the district attorney is also charging him with attempted murder of Coach Shirley, as well as charging Steve Abbott with criminal responsibility for each of Jamie's actions. Steve, the district attorney, alleges intentionally, knowingly, willfully solicited, directed, aided, or attempted to aid him. In the days and weeks after the shooting, the family became reclusive. You see, they'd received death threats and threats to burn their home. They've lost their son forever. He's going to prison, no doubt about that. They are the parents of a school shooter in a small town, and they bear that burden. The Rouses do not go to the Foster and Collins funerals. Mostly family and friends attend services for Diane Collins. The minister reads a letter from her older sister, who tells how badly she will miss Diane's laughter and her beautiful smile. More than 1,000 people attend services for Carolyn Foster. 6 television stations send camera crews. Ellison is afraid to cause the families more hurt. We're the last people they want to see. Cheryl agrees. She and Ellison are afraid to send flowers. They wish they could do something, anything, to tell the families of Jamie's victims how sorry they are. What about telephoning? No, Cheryl says. They wouldn't want to hear from us. In the end, they decide on the flowers. To avoid a stir, though, they ask people at Ellison's job to call in the order for them. The Fosters send a thank you note. Why has he done it? What could she have done to stop him? What has she missed, and how has she missed it? Guilt, shame, humiliation, disgrace, remorse, and mortification. There is absolutely nothing Cheryl Rouse can do to make up for it. She prays. Tell me what to do. Give me the strength to get through this. Help me to make sense out of it. But there's silence from God. You know, things couldn't get worse, or so she thought. At 10:30 p.m. on December 4th, two sheriff's cars roll up the gravel road to the Rouse's front porch. Cheryl is sitting in the brown cloth recliner. She's watching TV. Adam is curled up in her lap asleep. Go see who it is, her brother Steve says to Jeremy. Steve has moved in to stay with Adam and Jeremy while Cheryl and Ellison meet with the public defender, attend hearings, and visit Jamie. Jeremy is almost ready to go to bed. He opens the front door. He sees the sheriff's cars. Two deputies are moving to the sides of the house with their hands on their guns. Two more are going to the back door. Sheriff Eddie Bass, Investigator Michael Chapman, and two more deputies approach the porch. They ask, "Are you Jeremy Rouse?" "Yeah." "Could you step out here for a second?" And Jeremy does. "Turn around, put your hands on the house." They tell Jeremy that he is under arrest for soliciting first-degree murder. "What is going on, Sheriff?" Ellison asks. "They are arresting Jeremy for solicitation of first-degree murder. They have him on tape talking to another boy about it." You know, Jeremy hates the murders. Diane Collins was his girlfriend, then his best friend. And to be quite honest, he's not sure whether he loves or hates Jamie. The conflict makes it especially hard to listen to others badmouth his brother. In the days after the killings, Jeremy lashes back and sounds menacing. One parent complains that Jeremy has threatened to shoot his daughter. Two students tell Chapman that Jeremy wants to finish what his brother started by killing more teachers, and they say he wants them to help. Chapman asks the two to speak with Jeremy on the phone while he tapes their conversations. During one call, Jeremy denies ever threatening the girl. But when the conversation turns to school, he is ambiguous. Jeremy concedes he has said things close to what the students have reported. But Jeremy says that he was not serious about any of it. "I was just mad. I don't say what I mean when I'm mad." Now, because a public defender is representing his brother, the Rouses borrow money and hire a lawyer. And on February 22, 1996, Judge Robert E. Lee Jr. finds Jeremy guilty. Judge Lee has a reputation of being tough. He once used a bamboo cane to whip a 14-year-old boy in his office and gave the cane to his mother and father so they could whip their 15-year-old daughter. With Jeremy still in custody, the lawyer takes the case to circuit court where a jury finds him guilty again. And Judge William B. Kane sentences him to Wilder, a juvenile facility, until he is 18 years old or until he earns a high school diploma.
I bet you have been to Walmart at some time in your life and probably shopped there. I bet you even probably get groceries there from time to time. Did you know that Walmart has grocery pickup? And in fact, I can save you $15 on your first order of $50 or more. For more information, go to www.deuceconradshow.com and select promotions. There'll be a link there where you can sign up as a new customer. And again, you'll save $15 on that first order of $50 or more.
On January the 5th, 1996, Judge Lee convenes a hearing on whether Jamie Rouse and Steve Abbott should be sent to adult court. The judge permits Mike Bottoms, the district attorney, to enter a transcript of Jamie's interrogation into which Investigator Chapman has inserted a few days afterwards. His recollections of when Jamie nodded or shook his head in response to questions. Cheryl and Ellison know that Jamie's guilty. They know that everyone else knows it. They expect him to be convicted, and they have only the barest hope that his sentence might include the possibility someday of parole. To them, altering the transcript seems unfair, even unnecessary. When students, teachers, and medical examiners testify for the first time about what Jamie did, the Rouses listen in horror. After 3 days of testimony, Judge Lee rules that Jamie Rouse and Steve Abbott will be tried as adults. On August 2, 1996, Steve Abbott is convicted of criminal responsibility for second-degree murder in the deaths of Carolyn Foster and Diane Collins. He is convicted of criminal responsibility for the attempted second and first-degree murder, respectively, for the wounding of Carol Yancey and the errant shot that Jamie took at Ron Shirley. A judge decides Steve knew what Jamie was planning because Jamie had told him it's going to happen today. The judge calls the fact that Steve drove Jamie to school the most damning feature in this case. He sentences Steve to 40 years in prison. With a diagnosis of depression, Jamie is declared competent to stand trial. He does not want to go through a trial. He's guilty, so what is the point? It would only put him, his parents, and the victim's family through agony. So he accepts a plea bargain that gives him 2 life terms plus 40 years with the possibility of parole. The prospect leaves Cheryl in anguish. It means prison for sure, not a mental hospital. She cries harder than she has since the day of the shooting. Ellison calculates that Jamie's first chance at parole will not come until he is 70 years old. By then, both Ellison and Cheryl will be dead. At the last minute, the prosecution withdraws the deal. It is November the 10th, 1997, nearly 2 years after the shooting. Cheryl cannot sleep. She listens to Ellison snore and finally dozes off half an hour before the alarm rings. They have begun praying together, but on this first morning of their son's trial, they do not know what to pray for. Not guilty by reason of insanity. Cheryl knows that this would mean staying at the mental hospital for 2 or 3 years. She worries that it would not be long enough to get well. 10 years, maybe? But it would depend upon who was treating him. In truth, she thinks that winning his insanity defense probably would mean spending the rest of his life there. She knows Jamie would kill himself first. Maybe the jury will weigh his age and give him a life sentence with the possibility of parole if only he survives a trial. You see, for several nights, Cheryl has been having the same nightmare. People in the sheriff's office try to beat Jamie to death. Ellison, for his part, fears that someone will shoot Jamie at the courthouse. He and Cheryl will have to be careful themselves, and so they decide to park away from the building. The trial will garner national attention, and it will be on court TV. And Jamie says this means that even if he gets off, there is nowhere they can go and not be recognized. Well, maybe we'll move to Australia, Cheryl suggests, and they laugh. Whatever happens, she and Ellison ask him to promise that he will not try during the trial to kill himself. The trial lasts 9 days. The jury deliberates 4 hours and 27 minutes, and on November 20th, 1997, it finds Jamie guilty of 2 murders in the first degree for killing Carolyn Foster and Diane Collins, and the 2 attempted murders in the first degree for wounding Carol Yancey and shooting Ron Shirley. to recommend punishment, the jury deliberates 3 hours and 27 minutes and comes back with two sentences of life in prison without parole for the deaths. At a sentencing hearing 1 month later, Judge Jim Hamilton considers, one, what sentences to impose for the attempted murders, two, whether to run the two life sentences consecutively or concurrently, and three, what fine, if any, to impose for Jamie. Jamie Rouse will spend the rest of his life in prison.
Did you know that for the simple task of creating a Webull brokerage account, the company is willing to give you one free stock? Now, these stocks are currently being valued between $2.50 all the way up to $250, which is not bad when you consider that it's free money. Now, once you make an initial deposit of $100 or more, Webull will then give you a second stock valued between $8 and $1,600. Now, you will have access to these stocks as soon as your deposit settles, which usually takes around 5 business days. The stock selection pool is comprised of securities that have a market cap of $2.5 billion. They're U.S.-based, and of course, they trade on the New York Stock Exchange or NASDAQ. Their website states that when you open your account, you have a 1 in 100 chance of being awarded securities from either Facebook, Procter & Gamble, Starbucks, or Snap. However, when you deposit that initial $100, you have a 1 in 50 chance to garner a stock from a list of companies to include Google, Facebook, Procter & Gamble, Starbucks, Kraft Heinz, or Snap. Now, in addition to these odds, the terms of service go further on to explain your chances of ending up with securities of a certain value. Both your initial stock and the stock you receive after your deposit have different odds that you should be aware of. Go to www.deuceconradshow.com, select the promotion links, and from there you can sign up directly with Webull.
Prior to the trial, preacher Charles Anderson of Beech Hill Church of Christ baptized Jamie in handcuffs and shackles at a Church of Christ near the jail. It was just an unbelievable feeling of joy. My dad was crying and we hugged. He was crying because he was happy. I knew he meant it. I think he said, "Welcome to the family." Jamie writes a statement in longhand. The public defender reads it aloud in the courtroom. "I am sorry for what I did. I ask for the victims and their families' forgiveness. I cannot give any true explanation for what I did. For I'm not truly sure myself." Signed, Jamie Rouse. Judge Jim Hamilton decrees that Jamie's life sentences will run consecutively. He imposes additional sentences of 25 years each for the attempted murders to run consecutively as well. Altogether, he orders Jamie to prison for 2 lifetimes plus 50 years without possibility of parole. Until next time, I'll see you then.
Thank you for listening to the Deuce Conrad Show on Spotify Podcast. In case you didn't know, you can also hear this podcast on Google Podcast and Apple Podcast and most podcast platforms across the web. For more information about tonight's show, you can also visit www.deuceconradshow.com. Visit show notes for more details.